This is 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. This is Ozarks at Large for Thursday, February 13th, 2020. Ahead this hour, details about a new conference aimed at helping local musicians take advantage of their talents. After Ozarks at Large, on Here and Now, a continuation of a conversation with Brian Chesky, the CEO of Airbnb. He'll answer questions about violent incidents at rentals, as well as charges of discrimination, plus the latest news from the worlds of politics, economics, and health. Here and Now begins at 1 this afternoon, right after Ozarks at Large on 91.3. A couple of thank yous to hand out. First to Arcega's Coffee for hosting some of the Ozarks at Large team recently to help create a special blend for the 30th anniversary of this show as a news magazine. We'll tell you more about that soon. And thank you to the Rogers Lowell Area Chamber of Commerce, the Greater Bentonville Chamber of Commerce, and Northwest Arkansas Emerging Leaders for inviting me to moderate Tuesday night's forum featuring the Republican candidates for House District 91. Our partner Roby Brock from Talk Business and Politics is moderating forums tonight for candidates seeking the nominations for House Districts 90 and 94. That's on the campus of Northwest Arkansas Community College tonight, beginning at 6. Columbus House Brewery in Fayetteville continues a tradition this afternoon and evening, the beer and cookie pairing. They have five combinations of cookies and brew from 4 until 10 today. Tickets do have to be purchased in advance. You can find out more at the Facebook page for Columbus House Brewery. You do have to be 21 or older, of course, to participate in those pairings. This is Ozarks at Large. The Jewish holiday, Tu B'Shvat, is celebrated worldwide over a two-day period starting on the 15th day of the Hebrew month of Shavat, starting at sunset. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich was invited to attend a Tu B'Shvat Seder, or ritual feast, last Sunday evening at Temple Shalom in Fayetteville, and she brings us this story.
Members of Temple Shalom have gathered this chill Ransok Sunday evening for Tu B'Shvat. Rabbi Jacob Adler on mandolin, accompanied by Josh Basserer on guitar, warm up the crowd with a song about olive trees standing. Congregation established in 1981 counts 70 member individuals and families, Adler says. The temple built 10 years ago, and they've come tonight to celebrate the coming of spring.
It is, yes. Yes, and like a lot of Jewish holidays or a lot of old things in general, it's had many reinterpretations. Originally, it was a tax deadline. That is, you had to pay a tithe, which is essentially a tax on the fruits of your trees.
Traditionally, the collected tax was given to the poor as well as to support operations of the Holy Temple in Jerusalem, Adler says.
And so on Tu B'Shvat, people would go out into their orchards, and fruit that was already formed on the tree before Tu B'Shvat would be taxed with the prior year, and fruit that had not yet formed would be taxed with the coming year.
Basically an inventory of fruit, but conducted in a celebratory, even romantic way.
You can imagine what it would be like going out into the orchards, which was a beautiful bucolic country festival. So you go out and you look at your trees. Young people who didn't have much privacy at home would say, oh, we're going out to look at if the grapes are budded yet. And so they get to spend time together. And this seems to be what's described in the Song of Songs, let us go out to the fields. And it gradually developed into a mystical holiday. So the mystics have this conception of the tree of life.
The tree of life, as described in the book of Genesis, standing in the midst of the Garden of Eden, a tree of the knowledge of good and evil.
The tree of life comes from heaven downward. So the roots are up there, and the fruit is down here. And the divine energy, in Hebrew called Shefa, which is like the sap of the tree, comes down through the tree and it bears fruit for us down here, which is like the divine energy entering the world and giving us strength to do good deeds of all kinds, both like really religious ones, so the strength and intelligence to study, and the moral awareness and strength to help people out who are in need of help.
A third manifestation resembles 20th century Arbor Day.
Because at this time of year in Israel, it's a good time to plant trees. And the early settlers in the 19th and 20th centuries came to a land that had once been forested, but by then was desertified, turned into desert. And so they planted trees, and tree planting was a big thing. When I was little, you know, if you wanted to give someone a present on a special occasion, you would say a tree has been planted in your honor in Israel. Israel is the only country that has more trees now than 100 years ago. Everyone else has less. Israel has more because of this.
Tu B'Shvat is also observed as a Jewish Earth Day, Adler says.
We don't just plant trees, but become aware of our responsibility to take care of the whole environment.
Tu B'Shvat cedar or ceremonial feast traditionally involves the eating of 30 types of fruits.
You start with fruits that have a hard, inedible shell. And that symbolizes the lowest level of creation, and God's divinity is completely hidden. So you can look around tables and chairs and you don't see anything divine, and yet it's there. Without that energy, they wouldn't exist. The next level tree is fruits that have a pit in the middle, but fruit on the outside. And so you can penetrate more into the divine mysteries, but the core is still hidden. And then the next level, the next 10 fruit are completely edible. And so that symbolizes a person who has achieved a greater awareness of divinity.
Temple members take their seats at long white tables in the dining hall, where Miriam Cleansing fusses over a serving table on which she's carefully arranged bowls of various fruits and nuts into a tall tree shape, starting with hard-shelled tree crops.
These are the almonds. These are hazelnuts. These are coconut. Pecans, cashews, walnuts, pistachios, and this one is dragon fruit.
The beet-colored tropical fruit tastes like a cross between a kiwi and a pear. Next, she points to various pitted soft shell fruits, plums and peaches and olives, tonight symbolically drenched in olive oil. And last, she's arranged the totally edible fruits, palmellos, figs, and grapes.
And then, and in between, we drink wine or grape juice. And we listen to Rabbi as he explains things.
The cedar begins with song, followed by prayers and readings, one on the ancient history of Tu B'Shvat.
On the first of Elul is New Year for the tithe of cattle. Eleazar and Simeon, however, place this on the first of Tishri. On the first of Tishri...
Rabbi Adler reminds those assembled that this ancient Kabbalistic ritual originally was forbidden, except to those considered the most pious of Jewish scholars.
When I was little, I never heard of a Tu B'Shvat Seder, because it was something done by Sephardic mystics, and even if you knew about them, they probably wouldn't let you in. But gradually, the custom filtered out through the Jewish world, and now we have Tu B'Shvat Seders all over the world.
As well as in Fayetteville, Arkansas. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
La, 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 la.
This is Ozarks at Large. A few business items of note for this Thursday. The University of Arkansas Accounting Department will bear the name of an Arkansas business icon. The U of A announced yesterday the Department of Accounting will be named for William Dillard, founder of the Little Rock-based department store chain Dillard's. He died in 2002. He was a graduate of the University of Arkansas's College of Business in 1935. He earned a degree in accounting. The retail chain was founded in Nashville, Arkansas in 1938. Book lovers in Northwest Arkansas will have one fewer place to look for new reads. Nightbird Books will close on February 29th. In an email to customers and supporters, Lisa Sharp, the owner, writes that she's appreciated support from customers for the past 14 years and that the store will host a final goodbye on Saturday, the 29th, from 1 until 4. And an international cycling company is moving its North American headquarters to Bentonville. RAF, based in London, announced its main office on this continent will leave Portland, Oregon, for Northwest Arkansas. The office has been in the Pacific Northwest since 2008. The company released a statement citing a need to be in a location that will support its plans to evolve in the future. The statement also credits the proximity of the new office in Bentonville to an expansion of bike trails in Northwest Arkansas as a reason for the move. And ahead on today's edition of Ozarks, one of the newest inductees into the Arkansas Business Hall of Fame.
It was happenstance, to tell you the truth, and some of it may be a little embarrassing. My wife had a little something to do with it, who wasn't my wife at the time, but I got my degree in industrial engineering, and from riding around and talking and visiting with my dad, I figured out that there were business concepts, business thoughts that I didn't have a clue about. So I knew that I wanted to learn more from a business perspective.
A degree in industrial engineering leads to a career in banking. More on the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report ahead on this Thursday edition of Ozarks at Large.
KUAF is supported by Arvest Bank, offering a range of financial services from checking accounts to loans, mortgages, and more. Arvest is member FDIC and equal housing lender. More available at arvest.com. KUAF is supported by Packrat Outdoor Center, Northwest Arkansas's outdoor outfitter since 1973. Packrat offers work to wilderness clothing, footwear, and more. A primitive fire clinic takes place Sunday, February 16th, 521-6340 or rick@packratoc.com to register.
A draft ordinance to regulate short-term rentals in Fayetteville was heard by the city's planning commission Monday. The draft code is the culmination of 6 months of work by focus groups comprised of short-term rental and motel hotel operators, neighbors and citizens, and several public meetings, according to Garner Stoll, Director of Development Services. That's the department that oversees building, planning, and engineering.
Well, the basic concepts that we have in the draft are that they would need to get a business license, and they would need to have safety inspections to make sure that the fire alarms work and the ingress and egress is safe. Just the basic residential safety inspection.
Short-term rentals with business licenses operating zoned motel and hotel districts are currently legal to operate in Fayetteville, but Stoll says many operate in residential districts but are not policed. Along with deciding operating zones, the City Planning Commission is attempting to categorize types of short-term rentals for regulation. Type 1, Stoll says, are owner-occupied. Type 2, freestanding, unoccupied short-term rental apartments or houses. A growing number of cities are seeing a glut of short-term rentals displacing conventional home real estate.
Type 1's, you know, the principal structure is used for permanent long-term housing, and the visitors are just coming. So that doesn't take housing out of circulation, doesn't make housing less affordable. So the Planning Commission wants to make it easier to do Type 1 than Type 2. So we're going back with a proposal in 2 weeks that would do that.
A second Planning Commission meeting to review a final draft code is scheduled for February 24th at 5:30 p.m. It'll take place in room 219 at Fayetteville City Hall. If approved by planning, the ordinance will go before City Council for consideration. The city estimates as many as 600 short-term rentals operate in Fayetteville, most through online vendor Airbnb. Short-term rental planning documents can be found at speakup.fayetteville-ar.com. Elections.gov. Unofficial results show voters in Little Rock were perfectly split between two candidates in a Democratic runoff election for a vacant state House seat. But as Daniel Breen with our partner station KUAR in Little Rock reports, the tie may not be broken for over a week.
Joyce Springer and Ryan Davis each received 372 votes Tuesday in the runoff for Arkansas House District 34. Pulaski County Election Commissioner Joshua Price says that's a first.
No one at the Election Commission has ever seen it. No one at the county has ever seen it. So this is a very kind of a special case. Of course, there's been ties in the primary election or the general election, but not in a special primary runoff.
The seat representing District 34 in the House has been vacant since the death of Representative John Walker last October. His death prompted a special election, which will still take place on March 3rd, but seven provisional and overseas military ballots are still not included in Tuesday's runoff totals. Price says February 21st is the deadline to count those, and if a tie still exists after that.
I've had some people say, oh, do you flip a coin or something like that? I know that that's the popular answer or the urban legend. That does not happen in these instances.
Instead, the Pulaski County Democratic Party would select delegates from the district who would then attend a convention hosted by the state Democratic Party where a nominee would be selected. The eventual winner of Tuesday's runoff will face an independent candidate on March 3rd, with the winner of that contest serving out the remainder of late Representative Walker's term. Daniel Breen, KYR News.
This is Ozarks at Large, and it's not just on this program where you can find out about events and news connected to our area on 91.3 KUAF. We have features like the Community Spotlight each weekday morning at 6:30 and 8:30 with Pete Hartman, and Antoinette Grajeda's newscast of local, regional, and state information every Monday through Friday morning at 5:30 and 7:30. Throughout the day, you can hear public service announcements about upcoming lectures, arts events, and music. And you can always go to our community calendar at KUAF.com to stay up to date.
Welcome back for another edition of the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report. Paul Gatling here with you. With the start of the college baseball season upon us, we thought we'd take a look at the business of baseball in our upcoming issue. The University of Arkansas begins the 2020 season tomorrow at home with the first of a three-game series against Eastern Illinois. The Hogs finished the 2019 season where only eight programs end up each year, and of course being the College World Series. The Hogs did something else last year that's also rather exclusive in NCAA Division I baseball, turn a profit. The baseball program finished in the black in 2018-2019 to the tune of just about $855,000. The program had a total operational revenue of a record $6.73 million to go along with expenses of $5.87 million. Those figures are in the university's annual Equity in Athletics Disclosure Act survey. Arkansas and every other school in the country self-reports financial information to the federal government each year in order to comply with the EADA. The most recent numbers cover the 2018-2019 fiscal year from July 1, 2018 to June 30, 2019. So what is the big deal, you ask? Well, there are 299 Division I baseball programs. And those specific figures were not available. An NCAA spokesman estimated less than 10% of them turn a profit. In other words, unlike football and men's basketball, most athletic departments do not count on baseball as a revenue sport, even the most successful programs. Take, for example, the University of Florida. When the Gators won the 2017 College World Series, the baseball program ran a deficit of $3.57 million. Texas Tech has reached the College World Series for four of the past 6 years. In the past two fiscal years, the Red Raiders baseball program lost a combined $5.6 million. So how is Arkansas making money with its baseball program? You can find out more in the next issue of the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal. It'll be on newsstands next week and online at nwabusinessjournal.com. When we come back, we'll hear from one of the newest inductees into the state's Business Hall of Fame. I'm Paul Gatling, and you are listening to the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report.
Support for the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report is provided by the Arkansas State Chamber of Commerce and Associated Industries of Arkansas. The Chamber's mission is to promote a pro-business, free enterprise agenda and prevent legislation, regulation, and rules that hinder business. ArkansasStateChamber.com. First Security is proud to be only in Arkansas. They offer smart solutions for personal and business banking, plus convenient services and community investment. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
Business Hall of Fame inductee Rennie Rutledge says being in the right place at the right time had a lot to do with his success. Last week, Rutledge and three others were inducted into the Arkansas Business Hall of Fame, which is managed by the University of Arkansas's Sam M. Walton College of Business. Gerald Alley, Olivia Farrell, and Charles Nabholz were the other inductees. Rutledge is the chairman and CEO of First Security Bank Corp. in Searcy. That is the holding company of First Security Bank, which now tops more than $6 billion in assets. Rutledge appeared on this week's edition of Talk Business and Politics with Roby Brock. In a wide-ranging interview, they discussed Rutledge's induction into the Hall of Fame, his career in banking, the growth of the company, and the future of finance.
I've been involved with this Arkansas Business Hall of Fame since it started back in the late 90s. I was on the advisory board for the Walton College when Doyle Williams came up with the idea of having a Hall of Fame, and then our group put it together. So, and I've been involved with it ever since. So that makes it really special for me. And therefore, I knew a lot of the processes and a lot of what they were doing, except I didn't know that I was involved. But my family had a reason for me to come down and meet with Matt Waller, mm-hmm. the Dean of School of Business. He set up a meeting with me in Little Rock. And so we were going to have lunch at Cash Restaurant. So we show up there, and he takes me upstairs, and there's all of my family and daughter-in-law, sons, and so forth, my wife, and they surprised me with a lunch and telling me at that event.
Well, it's a good thing that there wasn't like a TV camera there. We would have had a Jimmy Johnson NFL Hall of Fame shedding a tear moment there, though. That sounds special. That sounds awesome. So
it was special. It sure was.
I want to go talk a little bit about your history and your background in banking. You actually you were an industrial engineer. Is that what you got your degree in?
I got a degree in industrial engineering from the University of Arkansas.
Find your way from industrial engineering to banking?
It was happenstance, to tell you the truth, and some of it may be a little embarrassing. My wife had a little something to do with it, who wasn't my wife at the time, but I got my degree in industrial engineering, and from riding around and talking and visiting with my dad, I figured out that there were business concepts, business thoughts that I didn't have a clue about. So I knew that I wanted to learn more from a business perspective, but it so happened my girlfriend at the time had another year of college. And knowing my fraternity brothers and other friends at school, I did not want to leave her with them for a year while I went and worked. So I decided to stay and get an MBA.
All right. Well, that's good. So you eventually, after you got the MBA, you went to work. You talked to a banker in Smackover, which is where you're from.
Right.
Who gave you some advice about, you ought to look into banking. You're going to be dealing with bankers for the rest of your life.
When I decided to get the MBA, my thought process was when I got done with that, I was still going to get an engineering, a technically oriented type job. And so I started interviewing for those type jobs the second semester for the MBA. And I had some offers. I just couldn't really get excited about it and what I wanted to do. So a good family friend, Max Mitchum, with the bank in Smackover, where I'm from, asked my dad to have me come by. So I went by and visited with him. And his advice was, since you don't know what you want to do, which is pretty bad when you're as old as I was, that you might try banking. If you're going to stay in Arkansas and be in any kind of business, you're more than likely going to be dealing with a bank. So if you try it and it's not what you want to do, what you learn will apply to business later in life. So that's sound advice, and took him up on it.
Yeah, so you did do some initial work in banking. You went to work for Worthen Bank at one point in time and then got the opportunity, I guess, to invest in a small bank in Searcy, Arkansas. $46 million in assets, I think is what it was.
Yes, so. I went to work in 73 at Worthing Bank and worked there for 3 years. Got married during the time to Ann. And we
going back that extra year paid some dividends for you.
It did. It worked. It worked out. That's exactly right. So we really enjoyed Little Rock, and we're having a great time. Young couple, no kids. Both of us from a small town. Her from Newport, me from Smackover. We knew we wanted to try a small town, and if we didn't do it fairly soon, we probably would never leave Little Rock because we enjoyed it so much. Mm-hmm. I had an opportunity to go to a bank in Springdale and took that opportunity. We went up there and spent only 9 months. I didn't mean for it to be such a short period, but an opportunity in Searcy, Arkansas came up, a $46 million bank, and we were able to make that transaction happen and went to Searcy in September of 1977.
Rutledge's three sons, John, Adam, and Nathan, are all central leaders in the bank today. Adam, of course, the Northwest Arkansas market president, and Rutledge says he is completely confident about the future of First Security Bank. There is a lot more of that discussion with Rennie Rutledge and Roby Brock, and you can watch it online at talkbusiness.net. One more quick banking note before we go today concerning the Northwest Arkansas operations of the state's largest bank. That's Little Rock-based Bank OZK. The company has hired Tim Doyle as Vice President and Commercial Lending Officer. Audwin Vaughn has been named Benton County Market President. Doyle previously managed the Commercial Real Estate Division for Waco Title Company and Springdale. Vaughn has worked for Bank OZK for several years and is relocating to Benton County from Central Arkansas. And that's our time for the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report. Until next time, I'm Paul Gatling. Thanks for listening.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda, and I'm joined now by Leah Udibe, an associate professor of music at the University of Arkansas. Hello.
Hello, Antoinette. How are you?
Doing well. How about you?
I'm doing fantastic. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. What have we got?
Well, it seems like we have Brass Week at the University of Arkansas Music Department.
Love it.
Imagine that, right? So on Thursday, February 13 at 7:30 p.m., Faulkner Performing Arts Center, we have the Septura Brass. This is a group of seven brass performers performing music for those instruments. We're very fortunate to have this ensemble visiting the University of Arkansas Music Department. They're coming all the way from London, England. Hmm. This is part of their USA tour. So they will be performing in this concert music by Rimmel, Prokofiev, Handel, and Stravinsky. The theme of the concert is Borrowed Baroque. Huh. So it's going to be really, really fun, all tied together. They bring a unique blend of musicianship and virtuosity through their performances. So it's going to be really, really fun.
Is seven a lot? That seems like a lot of the same kind of instrument. Is that
seems
no?
like it. Then you have, you know, the trombones, the tuba, the trumpets, and different colors and the arrangements.
I guess it's just not an arrangement I'm familiar with.
No, and you know, especially in Baroque music, of course, those instruments were not around at the time. So all of these are adaptations of repertoire with a very unique sound.
Okay.
You know, the brass ensemble is very... It's very versatile.
Uh-huh.
You know, we have had here the Canadian brass
right.
and all of those ensembles. They can be really, really fun.
Huh.
And I think this one will be
it's
in
outside.
That category. So this is Faulkner Performing Arts Center. Student tickets are only $5.
Oh,
and then they
easy.
Have the $10 for everybody. And that's it. Go. It's going to be fun. They're also giving a master class.
Oh.
And this master class is happening also on Thursday, February 13 in the afternoon. On Saturday, February 15th at 3 p.m. at Stella Boyle Smith Concert Hall, we have a free and open to the public concert by Ria Kaizuka. She is an euphonium performer. This is her first performing trip to the U.S. And she comes with a great repertoire in which she combines music by Johannes Brahms, Philip Sparky, Friedrich Haydn, Tetsunosuke Koshitani, and Yoshihide Ito. One of these pieces by a Japanese composer, Fidelity in Love, is a brand new arrangement for euphonium and piano. And this piece in this version was just premiered in Washington, D.C. last week by Rhea. And her pianist, which is our faculty, piano faculty, Dr. Tomoko Kashiwagi. So it's going to be also a really, really fun concert. She's very young. She was born in the city of Osaka. Uh-huh. And in Japan, she's a freelance euphonium player. She performs as a soloist. She's an ensemble player. She has been guest with various orchestras and wind ensembles throughout Japan. And she's just amazing. So it's going to be a treat to see her. Stella Boylesmith Concert Hall, 3 p.m., Saturday, February 15. I also wanted to start talking about the She Music Festival.
Yes.
That is coming in March. So I just wanted to make everybody aware that it's coming. Okay. Concerts and recitals and guest artists and talks, all because we want to put at the forefront the role of women in music.
And it's by the University of Arkansas's Music Department. Hope
it
you put
is,
that together.
Yes, yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. We have a lot of our faculty involved, whether they're in the committee planning and organizing and bringing guests or performing.
Excellent. So something to look forward to. We'll talk more about
Absolutely.
It here.
Absolutely. Welcome back to our conversation.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Leah Uribe is an associate professor of music at the University of Arkansas.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten, in part, by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. SONA, the Symphony of Northwest Arkansas, continues its 65th season March 21st at Walton Arts Center. SONA musicians perform the season's third Masterworks Concert, featuring Mozart's Clarinet Concerto and Beethoven's Symphony No. 3. Tickets at 443-5600 or sonamusic.org.
This is Ozarks at Large. This weekend, musicians in Northwest Arkansas will have the opportunity to learn more about making money at their craft. The Northwest Arkansas Music Business Conference will be held Friday through Sunday in various cities throughout the area. Sean Bales is a Northwest Arkansas native and co-owner of Echo Lounge Studios in Johnson. He's also one of the organizers of this weekend's conference. He says musicians trying to make a living off of their talent often don't have the mindset that music is a business.
You know, if I was going to go out and I was going to become a painter, the first thing you're going to do is, well, can I paint? Can I paint a room? Yeah, I can do that. Okay. Do I have the tools to paint a room? Yeah, I got that. Do I have a vehicle? Yeah, okay. Now I need a name of my business, right? Okay. Well, that's your band name, right? Okay. Well, once you've got that all figured out, would you just stop there and go, well, I guess I'll, now that I got the truck and the paint and the brushes and the business name, people just, they'll start calling. That's absurd. You know what I mean? You're going to start advertising. You're going to put your logo on something, and you're going to start building a brand, and you're going to start building within that brand the consumer confidence. This is who you are. This is the kind of job you do. This is what your product is.
Debbie Zavidson is with The Syndicate, a development group that aims to help musicians looking to build their career and establish themselves in the music business. She is one of the presenters at this weekend's conference, and she says once a music creator builds a brand, the work does not end there.
You got to figure out who is your audience. Who will like your way of painting a room? Find that core audience. Then you have to market to them. So there's ways to find who that is and how to go about that. Social media is a huge part of it. And there are ways that are smart ways to take advantage of social media, and there's ways that are more of a waste of time.
Zavidson says figuring that out, knowing how to craft a song that will be competitive with other songs in the market, and how to improve one's performance, some of the topics that will be covered during different sessions of the weekend conference, all in the name of helping give music makers a better chance of making a career from music.
The competition is stiff. It's more than ever now because of the internet. So we're just trying to educate, empower people, and not rip them off at the same time. Because a lot of times you will have somebody say, oh, I think they're great. Oh my gosh, look at all these gold records I have on my wall. Now, if you pay me this much money, I can make you a star. I can get you into this record label. When in fact, they take your money, and then I hear about it after the fact. And I kind of just got really, really freaked out and upset about how many people waste money doing that. When it's so easy to share knowledge and everybody make a living, but not rich somebody off.
Sean Bales of Echo Lounge Studios says the music scene in Northwest Arkansas is ripe for a conference to help working musicians make more of a career from their craft.
There's just music in the hills here, man, you know, and there's a lot of it, this is Arkansas has always been a great place for musicians, from Rosetta Tharpe to Levon Helm, Johnny Cash. We could go on. There's a lot of creativity here, and there's a lot of things going on, I think, within the community that, I mean, I feel like it's always had a pretty large music scene here, but I feel like it's even larger than it was before. I feel like there's more musicians here now than there has ever been actively out there playing, and I just don't see how you wouldn't want to learn some how to get better at what you're doing.
The Northwest Arkansas Music Business Conference has sessions Friday, Saturday, and Sunday in Fayetteville, Johnson, and Bentonville. You can find out more at the Facebook page for Echo Lounge Studios.
Drake repeats himself a lot.
God's plan. God's plan.
There's a reason.
When words and melody merge together in a simple, repeatable melodic fragment, that's something that gets lodged in our brains.
Unpacking the theory behind your favorite songs with the authors of Switched on Pop. Next time on It's Been a Minute from NPR.
It's Been a Minute with Sam Sanders, Saturday morning at 11 on 91.3 KUAF. This is Ozarks at Large. This is quite the week for theater. Productions from Arkansas Public Theater in Rogers, T2, Walton Arts Center, and the University of Arkansas in Fayetteville, Fort Smith Little Theater in Fort Smith, and another weekend of Sondheim at the Arts Center of the Ozarks in downtown Springdale. The ACO's second and final weekend of Into the Woods will be on stage tomorrow night and Saturday night at 7:30, then close out the run Sunday afternoon at 3. Tomorrow night's show includes a Valentine's dinner that begins at 6. The musical takes familiar fairy tale characters like Red Riding Hood, Cinderella, and Jack of Jack and the Beanstalk fame, and explains what might happen after Happily Ever After. Recently, we talked with a few of those involved in the production, including Michael Anthony Weir, who is the narrator and a character called Mysterious Man.
What happens to these characters as the consequence of what they've done in the stories that we remember? It's an interesting direction that the author takes us, and he uses these stories to create these extraordinary situations, which, you know, none of us are going to ever have to face, you know, like a giant or anything like that. But we do face our own personal giants that we have to deal with, and the reactions of the characters to these extraordinary situations, I think, are things people are going to be able to relate to in their own lives.
The music for Into the Woods comes from Stephen Sondheim, well known for wonderful and wonderfully challenging work. Shane Sturdivant, who is Baker in the ACO production, says all of that is true about Sondheim. The music is wonderful. It's timeless and technically difficult. He says the songs go beyond just technically challenging, though.
But it's also just tricky. It's in the sense that pretty much any musical you see, there's a repetition of musical themes, right, throughout the entire show. You sing the same melody to different words or things like that. But the way that he wrote this, in that he would change just little things in that tune from one song to the next, that you're having to catch yourself because you're like, wait a minute, that's mm-hmm. not the way that was written. And so it's not just, once you get the technical side of it down, then you have to deal with just the trick on your brain.
Into the Woods is directed by Julie Gable. She's previously directed musicals at the Art Center of the Ozarks, including last summer's Mamma Mia. She says she loves directing singers and actors for Sondheim in general, and for this show in particular. Yes, she says, there is work to be done with Sondheim, but the rewards for performers, crew, and audience are tremendous.
Not only the words and the relationships and the character, but the way he weaves the music thematically,
yes,
throughout. And this show, it's not like you have a storyline and songs are thrown in. There's music throughout. And if it's not a song, there's usually underscoring. So the orchestra is very busy. And I've been a fan of Sondheim's since I can remember, probably the 80s, early 80s. And he writes for singers, which is so great.
The ACO production features a full orchestra and all the bells and whistles that accompany an ACO musical. But Jane Sturtevant says the story takes people beyond the bells and whistles and resonates with audiences because the story addresses the human condition and that universal search for happiness.
If we're seeking happiness, that comes at a price. There's a give and take, right? There's a balance to the universe, basically. And that's where you find yourself with this story is you get to the end of the first act, everyone's happy, they've gotten what they want for the most part, or the way that I believe the narrator says it is those who deserved to be happy.
Which he says is an interesting and telling line.
We're now morally deciding who deserves it and who doesn't. But then to go on to the next act where now we see how high the price of that happiness was.
The Arts Center of the Ozarks production of Into the Woods is staged for a second and final weekend beginning tomorrow night with a Valentine's dinner at 6, followed by the performance at 7:30. There is also a Saturday night performance at 7:30 and then a Sunday matinee at 3. You can learn more at acozarks.org. This is Ozarks at Large.
It's the Community Spotlight. We continue our series for the Purple Project for Democracy, a national effort to examine civic understanding. Today, Suki Lynn Hires, civics instructor at Fayetteville High, talks about the history of voting rights in America.
Before the American Revolution, only white landowners of the dominant religion could vote. The Constitution gave states the power to set the time, place, and manner of elections as long as they did not violate the U.S. Constitution. And by the mid-1800s, Congress abolished property owning and the religion clause. This led to nearly universal adult white male suffrage. In 1865, the 13th Amendment was passed, abolishing slavery. Soon after, many states passed black codes, which took away the rights of African Americans to vote. In response, the 15th Amendment was adopted in 1870, stipulating the right of citizens in the United States to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of race, color, or previous condition of servitude. One of the things that was really important about the 15th Amendment is this is the first time that the Constitution has told the states who must be allowed to vote. But the Southern states found ways around the 15th Amendment. One of these was the Grandfather Clause. Only voters whose grandfathers had voted before 1867 were eligible to vote without paying a poll tax or passing a test. This was declared unconstitutional in 1915. There was also the literacy test and the poll tax. Literacy tests existed until the 1960s. For a literacy test, you might have to write your name and explain a complex piece of the state constitution in order to be able to vote. And the poll tax, which had to be paid every year, even if there was no election. This was a financial burden to all poor people. You had to pay well in advance of the election and show a receipt in order to vote. The literacy test and poll tax did not just disenfranchise black Americans. They also disenfranchised poor whites. In 1864, the 24th Amendment outlawed poll tax in national elections, but it took a Supreme Court decision in 1966 to outlaw it in state elections. It really took until the Voting Rights Act of 1965 to change everything. In 1965, new steps were made to directly regulate state-controlled election procedures. With the Voting Rights Act of 1965, the federal government could register voters, send poll watchers to make sure that there was no discrimination on Election Day, and just monitor state elections to make sure that no one was being intimidated from being able to vote. In the 1970s up until around 1982, laws were passed that abolished literacy tests and required ballots to be printed in minority languages. In 1960, before the Voting Rights Act, only 29% of African Americans in the South were registered to vote. By 2000, 65% were registered. Women began fighting for the right to vote in the early 1800s. There were marches, protests, lobbying, hunger strikes, and civil disobedience. In 1914, women had the right to vote in 11 states west of the Mississippi. But it wasn't until the 19th Amendment that women had the right to vote. Once women had the right to vote, they did not face the same discrimination that African American men did after the 15th Amendment. Once the amendment passed, they had the right to vote, as long as they were white. For a long time, the minimum age to vote was 21 years old. But then the Vietnam War happened. You had young men being drafted into the military to fight, and they believed that if they could fight for their country, they should be old enough to vote on the policies that led them into war. After many protests, the 26th Amendment lowered the voting age to 18. Despite all of the different fights for voting rights in the United States of America, we still have a very low voter turnout rate. In 2016, only 55% of the voting age population turned out to the polls.
This local series of reports is in collaboration with the Purple Project for Democracy. For more, wethepurple.org. You can listen to this entire series of reports from Suki Lynn Hires, a civics and social studies instructor at Fayetteville High, at our website, kuaf.com.
This is Ozarks at Large. There is good news about college baseball in February for fans. Simply put, it's time for baseball. But there is bad news, too. It's February. The weather is altering the opening day first pitch for the Arkansas Razorbacks tomorrow at Baum Stadium. The game will now begin an hour earlier at 2 o'clock because the forecast calls for dropping temperatures and wind chills. Arkansas hosts Eastern Illinois as well on Saturday at 2 o'clock and Sunday afternoon at 1. Those starting times, as of now, remain as scheduled. This is already the third weekend of baseball for the University of Arkansas Fort Smith Lions. UAFS, 4-2 so far in 2020, will play four games at Tarleton State in Stephenville, Texas, beginning tomorrow. Now, if you think mid-February is more suited for sports indoors, the UAFS basketball teams are home tonight at the Stubblefield Center for games against Lubbock Christian. The women tip off first at 5:30. John Brown University teams play in Oklahoma City tonight, facing Oklahoma City University. The Arkansas indoor track and field squads are at home tomorrow and Saturday for the annual Tyson Invitational at the Randall Tyson Track Center. Arkansas women, the defending national champs, are currently ranked second in the country. The men's team is ranked 20th. And also Friday, the Arkansas gymnastics team, ranked 15th in the country, is at Alabama. That action will be shown live on the SEC Network. And tomorrow, on a Friday edition of Ozarks at Large, Republican and Democratic candidates get a lot of attention this time of year. But political science experts say voters should be paying attention to the nonpartisan judges' races as well.
Because they make decisions that significantly affect people, often at a vulnerable place in their lives.
We have more of that discussion on tomorrow's edition of Ozarks at Large at noon and 7 p.m. on 91.3 KUAF. And don't forget, you can find complete editions of Ozarks at Large, as well as individual stories and interviews, at ozarksatlarge.com. You can also share those features with links that we have at ozarksatlarge.com with family and friends. And we do have a podcast. It's available on almost all of the podcast platforms like Spotify, Google Play, iTunes, and such. And you can tell your smart speaker to play Ozarks at Large and then hear the most recent edition of Ozarks at Large. Tricycle Farms' annual Fayetteville Seed Exchange returns to celebrate 7 years of swapping seeds and gardening knowledge to help the community members get their growing season started, not that far away. Annual event is held in the Fellowship Hall of Trinity United Methodist Church in Fayetteville. Additional community organizations will join in to amplify the education and resource information available to the community. If you'd like to know more about the event, it's free. You can go to Tricycle Farms on Facebook.
This week on the KUAF Vinyl Hour, we're celebrating Valentine's Day one day late by listening to songs and artists that we're currently in love with. With Wand, Stephen Malkmus, Caetano Veloso, Joel Almay, The Clash, and more. Plus, we listen to songs that preview upcoming shows in our area that you do not want to miss, like Steve Gunn and Courtney Barnett. It's a love fest of music this week on the KUAF Vinyl Hour, Saturday night at 5 on 91.3.
You can find a complete schedule of all the programs KUAF offers at KUAF.com. This is 91.3 KUAF, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Van Buren. 91.3 KUAF is a listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas. Contributors to this Thursday edition of Ozarks at Large included Jacqueline Froelich, who also delivered the information regarding updated regulations, or at least updated possible regulations in Fayetteville regarding Airbnbs, Antoinette Grajeda and Timothy Dennis. Timothy also mastered our show in the Herald and Blanchcock News studio. The Community Spotlight is produced by Pete Hartman in the Nancy Blair Operations Studio. You can hear new editions every weekday morning at 6:30 and 8:30 on 91.3 KUAF. The Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report with Paul Gatling comes to us through our partnership with Talk Business and Politics. You can learn more at talkbusiness.net. Thanks to Leah Uribe for her Thursday help with the program and to Daniel Breen from our partner station, KUAR in Little Rock. The ability to search our archives of 30-plus years at the show is supported by the Women's Giving Circle at the University of Arkansas. And Antoinette Grajeda is responsible for searching those archives for music to help us end some of our editions of Ozarks at Large, including this very one. She's picked Chucky Wags, who performed just for us in the Furman Garner Performance Studio a few years back. He will be at Chelsea's in Eureka Springs tomorrow night for what is billed as a romantic evening with Chucky Wags and the Company of Rags. The Valentine's Night music begins at 9 p.m. You can learn more at chelseascafeeureka.com. Here is Chucky Wags singing the song Dirty Old Men. Thanks so much for listening and making us part of your Thursday. We will be back tomorrow at noon and 7 p.m.
All right, here we go.
Smell that old familiar smell and feel a slap upon your ass. Feel a toothless smile coughing out a hearty laugh. And when you hear that same old filthy joke told over and again, that's when you know that he's right here, that dirty old man, dirty old man.